Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, welcome, folks. Welcome to the studios, the Big Dumb Fun Show, in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown Kansas City. We're right up the street from Costco's, not too far away, and there's a Subway sandwich up there on the corner, I think, and there's a lawyer's office. I used to actually practice law for a little bit, just about a half a block up the street when I first started practicing law. I quit practicing out of that, Aaron, because I just practice out of my house. Now it's a lot easier and a lot lower overhead. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Almost forgot that, folks. And we are here in part two of one of the probably the more interesting guests we've had with quite a history. And I know you've been listening to it because we're on episode two. He has written a book. He's a former mob, or as they call it in Detroit, syndicate associate. He's our good friend, Gunnar Allen Lindblom. Welcome, Alan, Gunner. I keep wanting to, whenever you got those two names, I get mixed up. welcome, Gunner.
How you doing?
We're doing
Gunner
great.
Gunner or Al. You know, Gunner's my middle name, but and most of my closest friends and associates call me Gunner, but Al's fine, too.
No, that's interesting how they get your names mixed up sometimes. On Skype here, it says Gunner A. Lindblom, so it's Alan Gunner Lindblom, huh? Yeah, who knows? It's like my son, though. I named my son Andrew Scott Jenkins, but he went by Scott the whole time. But yet, people that don't know him, they end up calling him Andrew, and then they say Andrew, and he doesn't know who they're talking to because he's only been known as Scott by most people. I should have named him Scott Andrew Jenkins. It'd been a lot easier for him. Anyhow, Gunner has written a book, To Be a King. And this book is kind of a what we'd call a historical novel of the Detroit Syndicate, or the Detroit Mafia, or the Detroit Combination, the Detroit Partnership, whatever you want to call it. But it's what we would call in Chicago would be the Outfit. And we had a discussion last time about the different names, so we'll just call it the Detroit Syndicate. Gunner, this has been fascinating to get this kind of your insight into the. We talked about before how the mafia developed in Sicily. I kind of knew some of that, and I'd read that, but you really, you've got it down. You've got that history down, and I really appreciate somebody that understands the history of things, because if we don't know history.
I learned all that from my grandfather. My grandfather was born in Sicily. His parents came here, but after he was born, but he was left back in the old country till he was five. And so he came back here, and anyway, he told me that whole explanation had been handed down to everybody in Terracini, where the family's from, Terracini, Sicily, for, you know, a couple thousand years. So it's a very interesting bit of history, for sure.
And so your grandfather was Paul Tocco? And he was a first Peter Paul Tocco, and he was a first cousin to William Jack Tocco, who ended up being the boss of the Detroit Syndicate.
Giacomo Tocco is who you're talking about, Jack Tocco.
Jack,
Uncle Jack's dad. Yeah, his father's name was William. His real name was Vito, but they call him Black Bill Tocco, William Tocco, real name Vito. But yeah. Cousins.
So you come by it honestly.
My mother's uncle.
Yeah, you come by it honestly. You got that blood running through your veins, that DNA all the way back to Sicily, when they had to band together because of the oppressive invaders And so they developed the mafia, as you said, to almost like a shadow government just for the people and to protect the people from whatever the invader of choice was, the oppressors, whether they were from the Moors,
would have
had it for a while from North Africa because they got clear up into Spain. And I don't know exactly who else, maybe the Egyptians.
There was the Moors, the Normans, the Romans, the Greeks, the Persians. Everybody wanted a piece of that. But you're right. It's the interesting thing I forgot to mention before is what a integral role that the Omnios played consistently, because there was no official form of government. These Omnios were like local kings, and they controlled Ducati, which is like, I guess they would call it, that would be like capo regimes or capos or bosses. Basically, what they did is manage land disputes, they oversaw a lot of things. Like, let's say you had a problem with your neighbor; he stole a goat or a pig, or your son slept with his wife. All these things were handled by the Omnio and his men. But these guys who were they were loyal to him. Eventually, he would give them land. He would give them their own farms. He would make them, almost like partners, and he'd take care of them if they were loyal to him. And they handled all the major disputes, and so there wasn't a lot of crime because everybody was scared of them. There wasn't a lot of adultery because that wasn't acceptable. There was never, domestic or violence against women. There was never rape. And so things like that, they kill you publicly. They bring you right out in loser's choice, basically. The Omni would say, how do you want to kill him? And they'd bring out, there's no pedophilia, no rapist, no nothing like that, because they handle guys like that. They handled people like that real quick. So, yeah, these Omnios were, like you said, local governors, if you will. And that's where the name of my book, the main character of my book, his name is Omnio Falcone, which they call him King, and that's why the name of the book's called "To Be a King." So, by the way, that it's a fiction novel, and so it is about a Detroit crime family, but it has nothing to do with the Detroit crime family. And obviously, some of it, the book has been inspired by my own experiences, and there's characters in there who have likenesses to people from my past. But you won't know who they are, and the reader won't know who they are. I know who they are. The people, and maybe a few of my closest friends and associates will know who they are, and anybody who knows of that person will know who they are. But the names are changes, the likenesses are changes, and it's all fiction, from my imagination.
The situations are mainly fictionalized, but they're probably maybe based on some things you heard or something you were involved in, or is it totally fiction? I kind of figured it had to be, some of the situations had to be based on real life.
Oh, for sure. Oh, yeah. 100%. Yeah, no doubt. I mean, it's obviously a lot, but I mean, it's a fiction novel, so, but there's for sure lots of things there. But like any author who writes any book that's a work of fiction, is going to have experiences from their own life that are embellished or that are built cornerstone for what he built off of for the story. But I was in prison for 13 years. I wrote eight novels. That was the sixth novel that I wrote, and I wrote it maybe 7 years ago. So I let, honestly, probably at least 100 guys read it in prison. The manuscript, pass it around. I mean, it was kind of famous. Guys were lined up to read it.
Interesting.
There was a waiting list.
Ah.
And everybody who reads it is basically calls it the next Godfather. Everybody, they're like, you wrote the next Godfather. And I've had people online who've read excerpts say that. I've had everyone in prison say that. I mean, everybody's just banging down on the door. Where's volume two? Where's volume? Where's the next volume? Because it's a multi-volume kind of story.
So you left the ending kind of open to go on to a next episode, shall we say, or a next volume. That's a good way to do it.
Well, volume one or two are one and two are complete.
So
I'll be releasing them almost coinciding. I'm going to release them both. When you get to the end of volume one, you're going to want to just continue on with the story into volume two. Then volume three and four are in my mind. So I said, but they're long books. So the volume one is going to be almost 500 pages. Volume two is going to be almost 500 pages. So they're not short stories, that's for sure.
Well, no. And folks can go out right now and go to tobeakingnovel.com, which is the website, and you've got like 14 chapters that are there, 250 pages that they can read just for free.
Yep, that's right. That's correct. Yeah, it's 15 pages, there's 15 chapters and the prologue you can read for free.
And you are putting, you are publishing articles from your life on the National Crime Syndicate Facebook page, too. So, folks, if you want to learn more about our friend Gunner here, go to Facebook and search for National Crime Syndicate and like that page. And while you're at it, go to Gangland Wire and like my page, too. But go to National Crime Syndicate and like that page, and then go to their website, National Crime Syndicate website, and you'll find some articles that Gunner's been placing on there about his early his childhood and his youth growing up in Detroit and kind of how he got going.
The website has, you can go there to six essays. They call them chapters that I've written. You know, they're all, you know, pretty long, but they're not real long, a couple of pages, but they're, you know, stories from my life. There's also an interview, so you can see those there. And Scott Bernstein from Gangster Report, he also carries them too. You know, he kind of syndicates and publishes them too along down the road and a couple other places, but I write for NCF. They're the ones who, you know, have been started the first one. They loved it. They got a lot of positive feedback. Thousands of people were, you know, just reading it, and everybody loved them. So I wrote another one. Same result. Next thing you know, people are, like, waiting for the next ones. So I'm like, ah, this is cool.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool. This is everybody loves a success story and a turnaround story, and you definitely have one. But let's go back to where we left off. We left off with you are a young guy out here running and gunning, as we called it, and you were kind of you're connected. You do things as an associate for some of your older relatives. For Was it Pete Toko that you may go and collect some money for, some of the other Detroit mob guys, but yet you're not really a made member because you can't be a made member, and you're collecting money, but you got your own action going, and we started talking about robbing drug dealers, and we've had a couple, three shows on that, and I just find it fascinating that's, to me, that's the baddest of the bad, Gunner, the people that got the guts, the balls to go out and rob these drug dealers, because that's some dangerous stuff there. So that's where we left off. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, if they're the baddest of the bad, then I'm the baddest guy you know, because that's what I specialize in. And I had a crew, a couple of guys who were fearless. And you're right, you got to be fearless when you rob drug dealers. But you got to know what you're doing. You know, this is one of those things. Like, I hope my wife isn't listening too closely in the next room. It's a scary thing. But basically, the way we did it, and I had a great hustle. So some of the guys in Detroit own strip clubs, ground zero for drug dealers and shady characters in general. I had a friend who worked in the strip club as bouncers and otherwise cook. And basically, they sell drugs to the girls. They find which ones are strung out on drugs, okay, which is easy play. So now the girls are strung out on drugs because they sell the drugs to them, and we did too, I did too. But now you basically go to these girls and you say, okay, here's the deal. When a guy comes in here flashing a bunch of money, you know he's a dope dealer because he's coming in here like playing the dope man role. A lot of them are black guys. You know, Detroit, you know, there's a lot of drugs in Detroit, a lot of black drug dealers. They all, the strip clubs on 8 Mile, they want to always get the strip clubs on 8 Mile. They don't know any better. And I attest this to the fact that a guy comes up in the dope game in Detroit pretty fast. He can go from a guy making $100 a day to a guy making $10,000 a week in a matter of, you know, a couple of months. And so when they get to that level, they want to play that role. So they want to go flashing their, you know, put a bunch of bling, bunch of jewelry on. They go to the, you know, titty bar and throw money around. They want to get two or three girls on their laps. And they don't realize it's all a play. So the girls are slick. You know, they're hustlers, too. They want the money. So what they do is, you know, they play into it. They feed the guy's ego and ask him what he does and what kind of car he drives and yada, yada, yada. They see him pulling out his knot. He's paying for drinks. Yada. So if a guy's got, you know, 5, 10 grand, 15, 20 grand on him, he's wearing, you know, another 5, 10 thousand in jewelry, you know, she'll go in the back, call us up, call me up, and say, listen, I got one to go. Because he drives a white Escalade, or he drives whatever, to him and another guy. And I'm like, okay, great. You know, so I call up one of my guys, Victor, had another guy, cousin Johnny, my cousin Tony. They're crazy as hell, too. You know, I mean, and we basically get zip ties and masks. We wait in the parking lot. You don't want to rob them in the parking lot because then they'll figure out the place. Also, the owners of the strip club, again, are all mob guys. You don't want them pissed off, you know, either. So we just follow them. 9 times out of 10, I've ran up in houses, too, afterwards. Most of those big drug dealers, they don't live in no dumpy house. They have a nice house, usually in Detroit, and they live with their girlfriend or their wife, and they drive a nice car, and at the end of the night, they go home to that house. But 9 times out of 10, they go after the strip club, they go to breakfast, and they go to the local Coney Island. They go down Gratiot or Woodward or wherever to Coney Island, and then they go in there and order up a big breakfast, and they're half drunk, you know, hanging out with their boys, playing the role. Well, we don't really care. I mean, we just put masks on and with shotguns, run up right into the Coney Island, where the whole place is in there, packed full of people eating breakfast. You know, it's 2:33 in the morning. Doesn't matter. We just walk straight in there, you know, guns out, shotguns, get on the ground, zip ties out, run the pockets, money, jewelry. That's it. Leave them hogtied on the ground and leave. Easy money. You walk out, you go back the next day, you call the girl up, kick her a couple $1,000, bang. Every, you know, it's easy money. And so it was very, it was an adrenaline rush for sure. It gets a lot scarier when you walk, when you have to, you run up in somebody's house, and you follow the guy home, you kick in his door, his wife could be there, kids, you don't know who's in the house, you know, you got to make a lot of noise, be real aggressive, and maybe pop off a couple rounds. It always works out. You always get the money. You know, but the thing is, you run up in a guy's house, you can get some big money, because then you start saying, where's the safe? Where's the money? Where's the safe? You know, and you basically tell them, today's the end of today, it all ends today, or you live to see another day. Make your choice. And they can't open the safe fast enough. They just start, you know, peeling off the floor, behind the dryer, downstairs, wherever, it's up in the ceiling. They start pulling out money that the girlfriend never knew existed.
Yeah, that's where the money is.
It can be.
And that's dangerous as hell. I've served a few drug search warrants in my time, and that's some dangerous stuff when you start kicking in on a drug dealer. I made a call one night on a drug dealer, and it was just a shots fired call. And the time I got there, when I walked up on the front porch, the front glass, the front door, and the wall, it was just shot all to shit, but shot from the inside out. Well, somebody had started kicking in. When I knocked on the door, a neighbor had called the police, and so he comes down all sheepish-like, and I said, what happened here, man? He said, somebody tried to kick in on me, and he said, I had my shotgun. I just started blasting, and I mean, they didn't get it kicked in time, so he didn't hit anybody. There wasn't any blood, but, boy, he blew the shit out of the front of his house. But that's where the money is. You're right, but that's really dangerous, those drug dealers.
Well, the way to do a house is you got to come in a house with extreme, like, shock and awe. You just kick through you just run through the door, blast a couple rounds, just start screaming and yelling, everybody on the ground, just go crazy, and people are terrified. They don't know how to react.
Oh, yeah.
But you do it within seconds of them getting in the house. You don't wait. You follow them.
Yeah.
You know, and then once they, you maybe go by their house, as soon as they go inside, I mean, no more than 90 seconds, and you kick that door, and they don't have time to even, you know, I mean, know what the hell happened.
You never ran into a reinforced door doing that? Every once in a while, you'll get to a reinforced door. I mean, we used to have a special big old...
like a battering ram.
Battering ram to take in some of those drug dealers.
Yeah, because you're raiding drug houses. That's the difference. I wasn't raiding drug houses.
You were hitting the drug dealer's home pad, and we didn't usually do that. You're right.
No, you're hitting the drug house. I'm hitting the guy's house. This is where he lives. I mean, it might be in the suburbs. It might be a nice place. But it's always a nice place. I mean, he doesn't sleep where he sells drugs. You know, I mean, not the big dealers. Not the guy who's got 10 grand in his pocket at the titty bar. I mean, the drug dealers, you know, the drug houses, that's a joke. I know crazy guys who would do that, but junkies rob those places, and they get killed. They can get killed like that. That drug dealer, he doesn't care about that 10 grand. He'll make that back.
Yeah.
No?
Yeah, you're right.
Not a big deal.
And they don't figure out who's doing it. They never kind of figure out, well, I went to the, you know, went to the titty bar, and then I went to the Coney Island, and then I went home, and somewhere along the way, somebody figured out I had $10,000 and a lot of jewelry on me and robbed me.
Well, that's the thing.
They never put it together.
Gas station. It could have been the kid at Coney Island. It could have stopped at the gas station to buy some cigarettes. Could have been that guy. Could have been the guy in the titty bar watching them there. They have no idea who set it up. They could try to connect the dots, but they don't know. There's some guys. They know it's some white dudes. They know it's some guys. You know what I mean? We got masks on, but they don't know who the hell or where it came from. They know whoever it was that had some freaking balls walk up in a Coney Island with shotguns.
2:33 in the morning. I would worry that there are other people there eating that have weapons as well.
Really? Do you ever worry about that?
They don't want the waxing either.
Some off-duty policeman in there.
Nobody wants to.
Packing and about half drunk and wants to be a hero.
It's Detroit. You would think most everybody's got guns.
Yeah, the most of they do, but they don't want to. When you see two, let me tell you, you got a gun, you're having breakfast, and it's 2-3 in the morning, and two masked dudes walk in with shotguns, sawed-off shotgun, automatic sawed-off shotgun. Look, with this, everyone say, mind your business. Everything's going to be just fine. What are you
going to
do? Play a hero?
No.
Say, hey, I'm going to help this black drug dealer.
Yeah, and you're robbing the drug dealer that's obviously a drug dealer. Yeah, I think you had a pretty good scam down there, my friend. I think that was, you had that pretty well calculated out.
Because that might have happened.
The cops wouldn't do nothing.
It could have been a cop, couldn't it?
In Detroit, it could have been the cop. It could have been a drug dealer, probably.
The cop could have been the drug dealer.
Anyhow,
exactly. Or there could have been cops in there, but they ain't going to
be gone. Yeah, they were. Yeah, I could see why. When you got two or three big guys and they all got shotguns and you can obviously that they're trying to rob these particular people. They're not just like taking everybody in the place hostage and.
Yeah, you're not robbing everybody. No, you're not going through cleaning out the wallets here. I hope I get my order to go.
Right. And even if there's a cop sitting there, he's like, I'm going to risk my life because to stop these drug dealers from getting robbed. I'm good. You know what I mean? That's how cops in Detroit are.
Yeah. Unless you get that one that's about half drunk like I might have been back in the day and wanted to be a hero. Thank God I never ran into that.
Yeah.
Anyhow, most interesting. Right. I have another question about this. Something I've always wondered about is when you follow somebody, do you just like tag along behind them, or do you guys get organized? I followed a jillion people with a crew, and did you have CB radios, and did you like run a regular surveillance, or were they just all drugged up and weren't really paying any attention so you could just drift along behind them?
Well, most of the time it's a single car. Sometimes we do it in two cars, but, you know, you get good at following people. You get good.
Yeah, you kind of know where they're going.
Away, stay back.
And especially when they're going to the Coney Island, so if they head that way, you just lay back and drive on, have somebody going up the Coney Island, pretty soon they'll pull in.
Well, there's a lot of traffic. You're talking about Detroit. There's people everywhere, cars everywhere. You just kind of blend in with the crowd. Don't stay a few cars back.
Yeah.
You got to time the lights. If you think they're going to beat you with the light, and that happens sometimes, just blow the freaking light. I mean, you're in Detroit. Cops ain't even. It's not cop. There's no cops anywhere. So, and even if there is, you blew the light. Half of them don't want no problems. They're not going to pull you over. You know, nobody has a license in Detroit either. It's not that hard to follow someone,
unless they're like
it's the wild west.
A sober mob guy that just is out late. You can't follow those dudes. They got a sixth sense. I don't know how many times I've been burned on some of those mob guys.
Right. Oh,
man.
I'm good. I was good.
You're probably good, too. I bet if you got a crew of policemen behind you, you knew it pretty damn quick.
I was going to say, I got followed by a helicopter one time. I just like in Goodfellas.
Yeah,
I had a helicopter follow me all day. It was creepy. It was right before I got locked up, actually, like 2 days before. They were on me, and it was terrifying because I knew they were on me. And you know you're being, you know they're taking you serious.
Yeah.
A freaking helicopter following
yes.
you around.
That smells of feds and the high end of the Detroit police and maybe the state patrol.
I knew my end was the feds, but I knew it was coming. I knew the end was near when I saw. I from 6 Mile and Shaner to like 19 Mile Road and Shaner. a helicopter basically was at my 6 o'clock, or at my actually my 3 o'clock. I knew, and then when I pulled in and like tried to hide under some trees, it started circling all over the place. I'm like, oh, this the end was near, and I knew it.
Interesting, just like Henry Hill.
What were you gonna say, Aaron?
So I was gonna ask you if you get a score, if you will, you rob a drug dealer, and you get the jewelry, the money, and you had said here just a little bit ago that you'd kick maybe a couple thousand to the girl if she was the one that gave you the tip. How much then would you wet the beak of
Uncle Pete or my Uncle Sal? They're brothers, but I usually with my Uncle Pete something like that, and the main reason is because him and his partner Artie, they own a pawn shop, and they're the guys who fenced all my stolen jewelry. I mean, all the jewelry. And so I'd usually bring the jewelry in there and give them a cut of that. You know, they're pretty good to me. They're fair. They knew I knew what it was worth, you know. So I'd go in there if I had $10,000 retail worth of jewelry, knowing that it's worth $4,000 in pawn. You know, they'd give me $3,000 cash. You know, I might kick my uncle like $500, $1,000. Tell him I only got a couple thousand, you know. Even if I got $10,000. I had $2,000 in his pocket. It's $500.
Yeah.
Give the girl a couple hundred.
Interesting.
Never honest. No one's honest.
Yeah.
It's your uncles. Why wouldn't you be honest? They brought you up.
Nobody's honest.
They're the ones that
man.
Told you, hey, that $100 bill, go get a kid to steal a $300 bike with it. Right?
Yeah, nobody's honest. I mean, that's the game.
That's the game. Yep, that's the game. That's for sure.
Yeah, it's when they get into that issue of, the skimming of the skim where they don't like that.
Yeah, Nick Sabella once stopped the skimming, called a moratorium. They called it, actually used these words, a moratorium on skimming from the Tropicana so he could see if any of his skimmers were stealing on their own. So
skimming.
Nobody is honest in those worlds. Well, it's really fun to talk to somebody that's been on the other side of a surveillance. That's really fun for me. I remember that Nick Calabrese dude. He was talking about that and how he would drive a nondescript car and wear nondescript clothes and some of the methods that he took. To maybe go into a parking lot and.
This is what I used to get them. Oh, this is funny. I'd get out and walk. What did they do? They hated it.
Oh, that'd drive you crazy.
It's the funniest thing. I just get out and start walking. They could not figure out what the hell I was doing. And I would walk like 5 miles. And they just keep driving by. They'd get down the street and they'd go real slow with the lights off. Then I'd stop on the sidewalk 2 a.m. and just sit under a tree and wait for them to drive by. I'd look at them. I'd wave. You know, they just One time they got me so good, though. They came out. We were playing that cat and mouse game. I was walking and I figured I'd dump my motorcycle at my buddy's house. Or excuse me, dumped my car earlier that night at my buddy's house. Well, my motorcycle was in front of my house. I was going to walk home the next day to drive my motorcycle to my buddy's house to get my car. But they were following me all over the freaking place. So I just got out and started walking. And, man, they were parked down the street. And it was so funny because they didn't know where I had lost them. So here I come, and I'm walking down the street. They're parked down the street, and the shadows under these trees and stuff. And next thing you know, boom, I'm right next to them. They act like they don't see me. I'm like, really? So funny. They just straight ahead. They're like shrunk into the front seat of the car. Then I get down the street, and right when I'm about to, my Ninja, my motorcycle is parked on the front lawn, on the sidewalk in front of my house. You get a ticket for that. So I was like, yeah, these douchebags want to be dicks because I was messing with them all night. They give me a ticket for having my motorcycle on the sidewalk. So I grab my motorcycle, start pushing it up onto my the walkway, and boom, one of these cops come up and pop out from behind a tree. They go, what are you doing? I said, what does it look like I'm doing? I'm moving my motorcycle so I don't get a ticket. Oh, man, he was so flustered because he thought, I don't know what he was thinking. That was up to something. And then all of a sudden the cops down the street came whirling up, and he jumped in the back seat, and they peeled off. And I was scared as hell because I had a bunch of dope in my house. I had a whole bunch of dope and guns. So I was like, damn it. You know what I mean? I didn't know what to do. I didn't turn any lights on. I was freaking out all night looking out the window. But anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's a game. It's a game. I know. I did a little criminal law after I retired from the PD and went to law school, and I realized it's a game on both sides. You know, it's just a game. It ain't personal, and we just play kind of a game. And
no.
Cops and robbers in a way, and it's kind of fun. And You know, at least at least for a cop, if you kind of stay square, while you don't end up in the penitentiary, which kind of brings me to my my next question: what were you doing that you ended up drawing the attention of the feds? You must have been doing more than robbing drug dealers, or something different.
The feds, I had been on the Fed radar for years, man. I got busted for steroids, selling steroids when I was 17. I was dealing with a guy and a friend of the family, a friend of friends, Italian guy. Who was a pretty big guy, still a big guy, and he got busted by the feds, and that put me on the radar because I was at his house buying steroids all the time, and then it just kind of, you know, my name popped up here and there, and I worked for guys who were constantly under surveillance, so I was always at the Hazel Park racetrack, picking up and dropping off things, well, usually dropping off money, getting lists of people who owed, and I'd have to bookies, you know, I gotta go meet these bookies, and I'd get money, and I'd bring it back, and I try to avoid the surveillance, you know, I'd swap out cars all the time and borrow cars. They had a Hazel Park racetrack under surveillance. It was my Uncle Jack's headquarters, and all the bosses hung out there all day and played bets and, you know, hung out, and it was Mob Central. They saw me. And then I got pulled in, and I think it was, I don't know, 96, 97, something like that. And they fed, there was a big roundup, bunch of people. My two uncles got pulled in, and a bunch of people got busted for something called Operation Game Tax, big underground casino night, gambling, dice game, just ton of stuff, gambling. And I got pulled in on that and questioned for, like, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours, but they didn't have anything on me, so they had to let me go. But they was always kind of in and out of their radar. And so they brought me in for questioning over the years, probably 3 or 4 times. You know, they always try to do that. They rattle you up. They grab you up, or you get a call, says they want you to come down and talk to you about something. There was this or that. And then I call them back. Do I need a lawyer? They're like, oh, no, come on down. A couple times they came to my house, and one time they arrested me and then brought me down and then didn't charge me. You know, feds, they'll mess with you. And, but anyway, on this, at the end here, I was, dealing with some, high-end drug. I was actually selling some drugs for a Mexican connection, and they advanced me a bunch of drugs, and I advanced them to cocaine, a couple hundred thousand, and it ended up, you know, I hadn't even been moving weight or nothing like that for very long. I had one customer. Some rich kid whose family owned a bunch of car dealerships, and I'd known him for years because he bought coke from me periodically for years, not very much. And then one day he comes into me, says, "Al, can you give me a kilo?" And I'm like, "Hey, let me see, you know, and I could make a few thousand," and I did. And what the hell, I needed the money. I just bought a new house, you know. And one of my downfalls was I started gambling. I started going to Vegas, and drugs. I was, you know, multiple drugs, pain pills, I was, you know, all kinds of drugs, ecstasy, and eventually was hooked on heroin. It was terrible. It was, you know, my life had spun out of control the last couple of years. And when that happened, I really shied away from my uncles because I didn't want them to see. And I didn't look like it. I looked like I had my stuff together. I had a nice house, drove nice cars, I dressed nice, wore shirts, ties, suits every day. But I didn't look, I wasn't myself. But normally I worked out and was like big and always training hard. I was in the gym. And when I started losing weight, not looking myself, I had a feeling they would know. And so I started doing less and less hustles with them and more side crap, like just selling dope with this kid. And he ends up getting busted. Long story short is I owed a bunch of money for this dope and I needed to pay it. So I just basically went on a crime spree, long story short. And this crime spree ended up with me in prison for 13 to 50 years.
Wow. So you were dealing with a Mexican mafia or some Mexican kind of cartel. You had a direct connection to good cocaine,
yeah.
and a kilo and kilo amounts. And you got this young Peckerwood kid or white kid who was just a rich kid, and you're selling to him. He gets busted. He didn't rat you out. He didn't turn on you. Kind of surprised.
I think he was going to try, but I think that the feds had me on tape for sure. So he was going to try.
Yeah.
But the feds had me calling him, talking to him. about the money, how I needed it. He needed to go to his parents to get the money. I didn't give a crap how he got it. You know, I basically told him, don't make me send some bad guys. And I said, if you got to go to your parents to get it, you got to get it, whatever. I got to pay these people. And I told him, you know who you're dealing with. You know what I mean? I think I even said the word, you know, you're dealing with a gangster. You know what I mean? I'm not a freaking rap artist.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. So he was, they had him tapped. They had him on a tap.
Yeah. Yep.
Maybe a rap him alongside the head.
Yeah, he's a rap. You're a rap artist upside the head. That's what you should have told him.
Yeah.
So he would have testified against you if it all came down. Anyhow, he would have given you up. They're that kind of a guy. I've dealt with 100 guys probably like that. They give you up in the end.
So who did you owe the money to? Colombians?
Yeah, you owed the money to his Mexican. Yeah.
Mexicans.
So how much money was it? Do you remember?
Yeah, they didn't.
Was it six figures?
Yeah, $280,000.
Wow. Ooh-wee.
$280,000.
You were $280,000 down short with a Mexican cartel dude. Was he actually Mexican mafia, or did you know, you know, was he had any affiliation with any organization that you knew of?
I know his gang, but I'm not at liberty to say.
Okay, I understand.
No, yeah. It was a gang. It wasn't Mexican mafia.
Okay.
A very prominent out of Juarez.
Yeah. See, those dudes, I mean, they're bad. They'll come back. They'll come up and kill your family if they need to.
100%. 100%. They don't give a crap about the mafia. They don't give a crap about nothing.
Nope, you're right.
They have no. There's no codes for. And they got an unlimited amount of soldiers. They just keep sending guys. You know, it'd be like Scarface. They just keep sending guys till you're dead.
Mm. So you have to go out and start committing crimes in order to pay this money, to save your life, basically. You're committing other crimes to make this money back to basically save your life, because you know this Beckerwood kid, he ain't coming up with the money. And you probably weren't using very good reason, hopped up on drugs and frantically trying to raise this money to save your own life and the life of maybe some of your family members. I can imagine that you would make a mistake or two along those lines.
Well, yeah, of course. That's exactly it. I mean, you nailed it. I mean, my option A was just kill the Mexican connection, but did they know where my family was and where I was and all that? Do I want to go kill this guy or whatever? And I didn't want none of that, no part of that.
Yeah.
So I figured I'd just get the money and pay him, if I could pay him, make payments and give him some chunks, you know? And then, of course, I couldn't bring my family into it, too, because then they'd think I was an idiot for even getting involved in the first place, because I wasn't supposed to do any of that stuff. So I was in a stuck in a rock and a hard place.
Really, yeah, the real deal, kind of La Cosa Nostra mafia, they don't mind somebody making money on drugs, but they don't want anybody very close to them too involved in that drug business, other than maybe investing money in somebody else that does it. But they would not look at you kindly.
Wait, so how close did you get to paying off?
I had already been warned.
How close did you get to how close did you get to paying off the $250,000?
Not that close. I think about $80,000 I gave him before I got busted.
Mm. So what was your, I guess, your final crime? What did you get busted for that you ended up there? Was there one particular crime that you got this heavy duty sentence?
I got extortion, armed robbery, conspiracy to commit bank robbery, multiple weapons violations.
Couple
of four or five others.
So they were really on to you. They must have had a whole task force on you, or a whole squad just on you and your crimes and following you. And did they have a wire up on you?
There's multiple task force on me. When I got arrested, I was brought to the Detroit 9th Precinct because I got in a high-speed chase. I ended up crashing, and I was in Detroit. That was the best way to shake a tail is in Detroit. And when they picked me up and tried to arrest me, I was on an expressway. And I got in a high-speed chase in a Denali and then crashed that, got out, took somebody's car at gunpoint, and then that thing ran out of gas. So anyway, I was in Detroit, and they arrested me. The cops come back there, and they said, wow, the guy says, man, you're a big freaking deal. And I said, what do you mean? He's like, everybody wants a piece of you. You should see a freak out there. Like the feds, the county, the sheriff, the three different guys, everybody wants a piece of you.
Probably the DEA and the ATF.
They think, he's like, they all want jurisdiction.
Yeah.
And so one of the ways one of the ways the state got so much jurisdiction is the feds didn't have a lot of evidence. They had no real evidence. The state had, like, you know, Macomb County had, like, I don't know, 17 charges. You know? And so they're the ones who took jurisdiction because much of my crime spree took place in Macomb County, which is the county next to Detroit, suburbs.
Oh, so you ended up doing going to state court. You ended up with state charges, not federal charges.
Yeah, now the feds tried for a minute, but there was nothing really they could, you know, I wouldn't say, give up anything.
Yeah.
So it wasn't worth their time to prosecute me for an attempted extortion. So they just let the state pick up an extortion charge or, you know, a different extortion charge. And so, yeah, 13.3 years I went to the state joint.
Wow. And so here you are. You are, how old were you at that time?
29.
29 years old, using drugs heavily, probably drinking a lot and smoking and out of shape. And it's like your life is over. I can't even imagine what that must have felt like, that your life, you must have felt like your life was completely over. I guess you just you take your time and just do what they tell you for a little bit until you can get yourself, you know, kind of figure out where you're going. Or the penitentiary that you were sent to, did you have any contacts or connections up there?
Well, I was at, like, I don't know, five or six different prisons over 13 years. But there's always friends and friends of friends and people that knew me from the streets in every joint. You know, no one close, no one real tight. There was only one real, like, heavy-hitting wise guy that I did time with in Dago Tone. He was the last person I was with. I was there with him for 3 years. He's from Sicily, an old zip that was from Sicily. He knew my whole family, knew my mother, went to my Uncle Jack's wedding. You know, so it was nice to be able to, you know, talking Italian with him, hang out with him. And so life wasn't over for me, and I never wallowed in my sorrow or felt sorry for myself. I knew it was part of God's plan and knew it was what was required to remove me from that old life and for me to start anew and a new life. So I didn't get involved in gangs in prison. I didn't do drugs. I didn't drink. I didn't do nothing. I just worked on my books, and I read a lot. And I stayed to myself, and I worked out. That's all I do. That's all I did. And I came out the other side with all my mental faculties in place and very healthy. And I got a great life. I got an incredible life. I just went fishing. I was snowmobiling. I had an amazing life. I've only been out 6 months, and life's good.
It is. That's an incredible story. I love these stories of redemption. You know, we all love the story of redemption, and me, because I've had my own little redemption in life, and I love these stories of redemption. You are a unique person. That's God. What you've been through, and to turn that around is God. It's tough. It takes the help of a higher power. And a lot of grit and determination fits right in there, too, with that higher power help. They'll show you the way, but you got to do the work. And you have certainly done the work.
Well, I give all glory to God.
Okay.
Give God the glory.
Aaron's got a question here.
Just a quick question here, because I think we had made the comment you were, when you did get arrested and they prosecuted you and they convicted you, you said you were going to serve 13 to 50 years.
Yeah, that was my tail end, because it was habitual. You have that floating tail. So if you don't behave well in prison, they can just keep you in prison, you know. And thankfully, I behaved well in prison. I went to college. I was a model inmate. And when I saw the parole board for the first time, the stars really aligned up. I was one of 148 guys out of 48,000 who got a scholarship for college. And because of an essay I wrote, and they picked us because based on our county and all these other things, but we all, like 500 guys, had to write essays, why would you want to go to college, and then 140 got picked. But then and that's a big reason why they let me out, because there's an outside party donated the money for these scholarships, and they wanted to see if we have less recidivism, meaning this group of 140 percentage-wise is less likely to go back to prison if you give them an education.
Yeah.
This money came from the Vera Group out of New York, which had been donated by the Bill Gates Foundation. So that was one of the main reasons they almost had to let me out. Plus, I had a big family support. My family was really on them, you know, my wife. And so I got lucky. I got out early. A lot of guys don't get out on their first parole. They might stay 2, 3, 5 more years, you know.
And you can find that you're online at tobeakingnovel.com.
Yep, exactly.
And you can read what? How many chapters of that you can already read on the, so if you see if you even want to spend your money on it?
There's 15 chapters and cool. A prologue, roughly almost 300 pages of that. You have, it's a 30 pages, the first volume is 30 chapters. So there's that, and then volume 2 will be available immediately. And also, you know, check out the Lindblom Chronicles at the National Crime Syndicate website and or Facebook. They're pretty, you know, they give you more of a in-depth written window into my previous life. You know, just kind of funny stories, not funny, but stories from my past, interesting stories, I guess is a better word for it, how I started, and some of them are funny.
But, anecdotal stories.
Exactly, anecdotal, perfect word. That's anecdotal stories from my past, and good stuff, giving more of a window into me. And then also, you can, there's a link there always for the, if you want to check out the book.
All right. Well, let's wind this on down. You know, this has been a great, great interview. I know you guys been sitting here at the table with me. You're not really sitting at the table with me, but it feels like you are, because I've gotten to know a lot of you that are listening out there. Gunner, they're going to love this interview. They love those little inside stories like that, and I do too, because it makes a lot of sense to some of the things. You've made a lot of sense to some of the things that I did in my past that sometimes were confusing to me. And you know, you kind of operate in a vacuum, it feels like, sometimes when you're trying to investigate some criminal organization whose job it is to keep you from finding out anything that you can about it. So it's been a great interview for me. I hope you've enjoyed yourself.
I have. I've enjoyed myself, and hope I can help. Maybe down the road I can do another one. But anything I can do to help try to promote my own book, because again, I'm trying to make a living as a writer, and you know, and I put a good product out there. I just need people to get sample the product so they know that I'm a real writer. I'm not just some guy who came out of prison, wrote a book in prison. I'm the real deal.
Yeah, that's the deal, is you can have a good product and it can just die on the vine. You got to figure out a way to get it out there. I understand that. And we'll help
exactly.
Every way we can with our people, and we'll encourage them to look at it and read it and buy it and to then tell their friends about it, because that's how it works. That's the magic
exactly.
of social media marketing. Well, you know, back in the day, people like you and I, we didn't have a chance. There was like 2 or 3 publishing companies and you know, you didn't have a chance unless you had some kind of a connection into doing that. So
right.
Thanks to social media marketing and the computers and the digital world, why we got a chance to get our message out too. So I'm going to make my public service announcement. Alan, I always like to make this. I did some volunteer work for this agency, and I see how many families who had addicts in their family that this company is nonprofits helped. And so I always try to I give them money, and I go to their events, and I always mention them on my podcast, even though I don't know if anybody's ever got any help out of it. But I like to think they do. It's if you have a friend or a relative or a loved one that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I've got to say, this has been a great interview, and we really appreciate Alan taking the time to talk with us. It's nothing better than a classic gangland wire when it's from the mouth of the men that did it. And if you want to get more of that, certainly download other great Gangland Wire crime story podcast episodes, but definitely go out and get the Kansas City Mob Tour app, because you can take your own personalized tour of Kansas City mob locations in and around the city. Also, of course, get the book that Gary just published, Leaving Vegas.
How the FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
And, of course, you can make a donation to Gangland Wire, or you can become one of our Patreons and do the monthly subscription. And for that, we have special digital downloads and items that we will share with those folks. And for a donation of $25 or more, if you're in the United States, of course, we will send you an autographed copy of the movie, the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire.
Or the book. Maybe the book, too. It depends on how much money you give. Go on my donate page and take a look. See if you want to be an associate, a soldier, a capo, a don, or a capo de tutti di capi. I think that's how you pronounce that. Would you say that was how you pronounce boss of all bosses, Gunner?
Yeah, you said it pretty close.
Oh, good. Good night, Gunner. It's really been great talking to you.
Okay.
Say good night, Aaron.
Good night, Aaron.
Thanks.
All right, good night, Gary.
Night.
Bye,
Aaron. Bye. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Find them on Facebook at Odd-O-Matic Music.
On the advice of my lawyer, I respectfully refuse to answer that question, as my truthful answer may tend to incriminate me.
This is the best thing. But, you know, bookies, they pull a lot of money, man. I mean, because there's a lot more than connected to bookies, because there's loan sharking that's connected to bookies. And then there's guys like me who got to collect from Welch's who don't want to pay the bookies. And then they got that keeps me in work. A guy like I used to, that was kind of like my job was. If I had to say what my full-time job was, which sucked, was running around collecting from bookies.
Yeah.
Or collecting for bookies. The bookie would call the boss. And the boss would call Uncle Sal. And Uncle Sal would call my Uncle Pete. And Uncle Pete would say, all right, listen, Al. Here's the guy. This is where he works. This is where his house. He freaking owes X. You get that, you get 10%. So now I got a list of guys, and I'm just driving around all day trying to find where, you know, if I'm, on a good day, I might make $2,000 or $3,000. A bad day, I might make nothing or a couple $100.
Yeah, and these guys.
Pain in the ass. I hated doing it.
These guys probably not trying to be found at the point that they owed that much money. That somebody says, hey, you need to go collect.
Of course. No, they're all hiding. But, you know, we'll find them. I'll find them. I'll go to a girlfriend, a friend, a buddy, or whatever. And, you know, and eventually somebody will give them up, and I'll end up at his work or his girlfriend's house. Or, you know, and I tried to be a nice guy. I used psychology. Rather than be an asshole and threatening, I'd say, listen, man, I get it. You know, you fell behind, but you got to pay something. And you can't hide from us because the next guy won't see him coming. And I'd be like, so what do you got? You know, you got some money, some jewelry, you got a coin collection, you got some rims. I'd take whatever. At least it didn't matter. I'd work with a guy. He has a gun collection. Or a lot of times, a guy would help me with a score. Like, all right, here's the deal. Do you know what he's got? Like, where do you work? They got a safe in the back. You know, could you leave the back door open? Whatever, you know. Find a way to, if I hit a, you know, if you could help me hit a, you owe $8,000. You help me hit a $10,000 score. You know what I mean? We'll kill your debt, and maybe even you make a couple bucks.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying. So
I knew a guy once I knew a guy once that his deal he got in, and he worked on a warehouse, and this was back when Polaroid film was hot, and he knew they had a ton of Polaroid film that went through their docks, and so his deal was. Every week he would steal so many cases of Polaroid film and then take it to this other guy that was fencing it, and that's how he handled his. And what was funny about it is he left town, moved somewhere else, another part of the country, and he sold that concession to another guy, that connection to another guy there where he worked, and then they started stealing the Polaroid film and taking it to this same fence. It's that gambling. It's not. It's more than just the gambling, isn't it? There's a whole lot of other crimes and things.
Exactly.
And when you got all these addicted gamblers out there, they'll do anything to keep gambling, and they'll continue to lose, and they'll continue to lose. Only the bookie makes some money.
That's how you keep a whole family employed. You know what I'm saying? Really, is you got a bunch of degenerate gamblers and everything connected to it. Keeps everybody making a ton of money as long as they keep gambling.
Yeah.
So I mean, I could go on all day. We don't have enough time. When you just brought that up about the Polaroid film, I like 20 different things came to mind that are similar to that.
Yeah.
Like, I could just tell you 20 different scams. that you did. You're just always trying to work, you know, find a way. Everybody's got something. They don't even know it. Sometimes you got to push them into realizing there's an opportunity here. You know what I mean? That's what I did.
Yeah. All right. I think we've pretty well done this. I don't have any more questions. I'm kind of questioned out.
I guess I did have one more question. Sorry, no, we're way over the driveway time here. But
that's all right.
Uncle Sal and Pete Toko also had passed away. Can you talk a little bit about that in terms of they had? I'm assuming maybe you were in prison at the time, not your uncles.
Yeah, they both died. I just found out my Uncle Pete died just recently because he was in the Fed joint in. The last I knew, he was supposed to be getting out a couple years ago, right? And my sister doesn't talk to me anymore, but my dad told me, I don't know if you know, but your Uncle Pete died. I was waiting for him to get a hold of me. And the only reason I thought he probably didn't get a hold of me since he got released from prison, he knew I got out, is because he probably was like, listen, I don't want him going back to the life or going back into stuff. I'm going to let him just go on with his life. That's what I thought. And then my dad's like, well, yeah, your uncle got out of prison and died. They died in Colorado. He's out in Colorado. So my Uncle Sal died several years back, too. Died of a heart attack. You know, he was in bad shape. He got shot when he was young. He had paralyzed arm. His son didn't want nothing to do with him because he got divorced and his wife took my cousin away from us and got a court judgment saying that she doesn't want their son to do with anything to do with our family because of the criminal element and all this crap. And the judge gave her took the kid away. And so now he could only have supervised visits. It broke his heart. He never recovered. He just, he was just pretty bad off ever since then. And he doesn't want nothing to do with me either. I tried to look him up on Facebook. My friend requested him. He never answered. So what are you going to do?
Yeah, well.
That's life.
Huh.
Yeah. Well, you got kind of a new life, so that relationship will probably heal up if it's meant to be one day, sooner or later.
Yeah, I'm hoping.
And you've got a book to promote, of course.